Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 2 of episode 38, where we are discussing John von Manen's paper, Police Socialization, a Longitudinal Examination of Job Attitudes in an Urban Police Department, published in Administrative Science Quarterly on 1975. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1, it might be worth doing so, as this is when we introduce the text, discuss its key ideas, and explore its position within the organization and management field. In this part, we are going to continue with the discussion of major themes and focus on the implications of the text for our understanding of socialization, as well as dynamics related to hiring, career, commitment in organizations today. And now, back to the conversation.
Reading the article, obviously there's a lot of parallels that we can draw between police forces and military forces, such as where my background is in, because we do entry-level activities that are very similar to what the police does, and we bring people in at the enlisted level. You bring them into a boot camp, which serves the purpose of getting them out of who they were and getting them into the socializing them into the organization. Do something very similar at the officer level, where we begin the socialization process at either through some sort of an officer candidacy school or, say, at a military academy. And the purpose is all kind of the same. Now, in the current context, I think what is interesting is that we've, in part, because of Van Manen's study and those that have come after it, we're much more attuned, perhaps, to the socialization process than we used to be. And we may even be a bit more concerned about whether or not the socialization process, if it's, say, too rigid, if it's actually benefiting the organization. And just to kind of give you an example of where we can go with this, on the one hand, the socialization process and the career patterns that we establish for junior enlisted and junior officers are meant to ensure that they are completely enculturated, that they are performing well, that they gain experience in the basic matters of being a soldier, a sailor, airman, or marine. Okay? Now, what that is kind of built, because military organizations promote entirely from within, we do not take people off of the street and put them into high-ranking positions, by and large. What that does is that socialization process really kind of takes hold and it forms what becomes the expectations at higher ranks. I mean, you're basically, this socialization stays with you through your career. And this was actually in part of the subject of my own dissertation study on mid-grade officers entering the senior levels. So now the global environment is dynamic and complex. It's producing or presenting us with situations where we need to have a little bit more ability to be innovative, creative, adaptive. There's a lot of that that's coming out in talks from not just senior leaders, but from throughout the force, that the way of growing talent in the past, which was kind of designed around a very, very strong culture, may not be what we want for facing the threats that we face in now and into the future. However, the strong socialization process serves its purpose, and it gets people acculturated into the military. So we kind of need that, but yet we need this innovative, you know, you can see the paradox that's kind of forming. And so we've talked a lot about how do we build innovative cultures within military organizations, and it's extraordinarily hard to do, at least on a grand scale. There's, you know, there's a lot of innovation that occurs at the micro level or small scale, localized, what have you. But trying to build that across a whole military force is very difficult because we're not sure that we want to get rid of the benefits that we get from the currents, from the socialization processes. Now, I'm kind of glossing over the fact that the socialization processes we use have modified over time. Boot camp today is not the same boot camp that was done 50 years ago, but the purpose is largely the same. It's to get people into the military culture. So I thought I'd offer that. How do you build an innovative culture in the midst of a strongly socialized culture that has been rather enduring?
Well, can I probe you a bit on what does innovative mean? I'm going to be a bit provocative, you know, because I think the question is, you have a system that is prone to ensure conformance. And then the question can be, so you think that there should be more space for autonomy, for dissent, for proposing ideas that can be good solutions, but they're just haven't been done before? You know, what are we talking about? Because I think there are different kind of requirements depending where, how far you're, you know, how loose one is willing to go.
And that's an excellent question, because I think that is part of the problem. When we're talking about innovation, we could be talking about several different things. Let's take on the personnel side. That's one aspect. Autonomy, dissent, all of those, that's one part of it. Another is a bit more structural. Because the structures, like when we think about a military unit, a battalion or a brigade or an engineer unit, or, you know, there's a lot of doctrine and a lot of history that goes behind how those organizations were structured. And the purpose for having them standardized is pretty straightforward. We need to be able to plug and play. We need if we have to assemble a force, we have to know that if we're going to call for a particular type of a capability, that we know what we're going to get in return. If you don't standardize, you run into problems with that. So then, from a organizational structure, a doctrine standpoint, you have to think about, how do you test out new ideas? And so we start getting into testing, experimentation. And experimentation is a difficult thing to do on a large scale. You either have to have experiments that are kind of isolated from the rest of the force so that the rest of the force isn't negatively affected while we're experimenting. Or you do very, very low-level experiments spread widely across the force. I know this is tough to describe, but basically you put out an idea and you let people go at it, and the best idea wins, you know, that sort of a thing. How you do that systemically, given that resources are always constrained and it's difficult to, you know, you have to, if you're going to put money into experimentation, you've got to have a really good idea that the benefits are going to outweigh the cost, that there's going to be a return on that investment. And so the structure, between the structure side and the people side, you have those two ideas about innovating can come into conflict.
Well, there's also, I think, just thinking of what is different between a military organization and a police force type of organization. A military organization has as its task, one of the tasks anyway, is to come up with ways to kind of actualize or like create capabilities that would adhere with the doctrine. So there is an inherent innovative aspect present there, almost teleologically speaking, whereas a police force is, you know, it's enforcing the existing kind of legal framework or whatever. There isn't, I think, or I sense, and certainly I don't see that in Van Manen's work, there isn't a drive to come up with better ways to enforce the law.
Well, that may be true at the patrolman's level, but unquestionably the law enforcement framework is constantly trying to improve. And I think one of the examples that I can give, and I would be interested if this has really been studied, is in DNA testing. So, you know, before, in the absence of DNA testing, say at the time of Van Manen's work, an investigation, you know, you had basically limited tools compared to today to be able to conduct the investigation and to be able to build and handle, or not build, but collect and handle evidence and present it at trial and all that. And a lot of times the answer comes out wrong because the evidence that was collectible points to the wrong person. And how many, ever since DNA testing became available, how many innocent people have been released from jails because the DNA tests done 15, 25 years after the fact have proven innocence? It's it has certainly changed the way in which law enforcement investigates a crime after it's been committed. And that's kind of, that's not at the patrolman level, definitely. This is part of the enabling structure that's above, you know, at the city or state. In the United States, is it a lot of it's at state level and also federal level. So there is a strategic level attempt to try to make the law enforcement architecture much more effective and efficient. It just doesn't always necessarily translate down to, say, what the individual patrolman does when they're walking the beat. But it definitely comes into play after a patrolman has had to do something and starts to go through all of the administrivia when they get back to the station after they've done something.
Yeah, I guess I was conflating things like forensics and, you know, R&D with the operational aspects of it. No, you're totally right.
I want to try to complexify what you have been talking about, you know, because it seems that we, you know, I just became aware myself, you know, thinking about what we have been talking. There seems to be almost a duality in our idea that, you know, there is conformity and the push for socialization that produces a very uniform culture and the necessity of, in a word that's always dynamic, it's always complex, there is the need to innovation either at the personal level, at the more structural level, but there is a need for, you know, new ideas of doing things. If you think about it, there is actually some research done about organizational cultures, which prize, I would say, discipline and conformity, that shows a different aspect to it. So I'm thinking specifically at the work of Gideon Kunda on a large engineer organization that he calls TEC, in which he was looking at how this company, in a way, instills a sense of commitment within the technical workforce. And the idea being that you want people that are very technically savvy to use their brain power and their capacities to towards the projects of the organization, the main ones that have been, you know, put forward, not just be tinkering around different things and exploring, but being concentrating all your energy on what has been sanctioned at the right kind of, you know, outputs that should be worked on. So in a way, I think it's a more complicated situation in which we can have the pressure to conformity in order to have the innovation that is expected as, you know, from that, as expected as the official one, so to speak, as the desirable one.
That's a good connection, and it also very much fits with what we did in episode 30 when we were looking at corporate culturalism, which would basically be the idea that, you know, you're free to do whatever you want as long as, you know, that is what is sanctioned. And the Van Manen study kind of is an extreme version of that, that what is sanctioned is so narrow and so restricted to the established frameworks that the degree of individualization is almost non-existent. Whereas, of course, in Kunda's study, there's a bit more leeway because the individuals working in that particular company in that he's describing in his book, Engineering Culture, they have more, not legitimacy, but more weight as to their individuality than a patrol officers do, who are, I guess, I don't know if it's fair to say or not, but they're more cog in the machine-ish than those guys in Kunda's study.
Mm. Well, I think it's something to do with, and I think Van Manen touches upon that as well, is that the work of the policeman is harder to standardize and predict in a way. So the emphasis is on molding a certain kind of attitude. Whereas maybe the engineers, the emphasis is more, you know, getting them to do specific tasks that you can kind of, you know, anticipate, divide, project manager, and review. You know, so that maybe there is why they don't have so much space for their own individuality, because that's the thing that is easier to control in that situation.
That's true, and it's actually great that you pointed it out, because towards the end of the paper, he does say this explicitly, that even though most patrol officers dismissed their experience at the academy as virtually useless to the actual performance of the work, which is what they learned with their partner on the beat while already being a patrol officer, it was the attitudes that were instilled at the academy that were valuable. And it's kind of this more normative molding, as you said, that is going on there.
But so just a question that popped into my mind while we were discussing this. Could it also be the case that this enhanced sense of conformity is also related to the fact that when you choose a career in the police force, it's kind of like a career for life? In the sense that, differently from other organizations, we've mentioned, I don't know, engineers, we've mentioned, I can't remember what else, but you have, different times in our discussion, we've mentioned the fact that we expected some sort of description of the skills, but actually what we got was a description of socialization. So I was thinking, okay, if I start a career in the police force, and for some reason I'm not happy, do I have alternative career paths? I'm not sure, maybe not many, because there's a lot of research which links employee turnover to employee silence, or the possibility of employees, the opposite, to voice their concerns. If we're talking about organizations that tend to conform, so there isn't much voicing of concerns, but there's more conforming to how things go, it's also maybe because there is no possibility of having an employee turnover on an individual level. You're there, you've chosen it, you continue. I don't know. I'm just opening it up.
Well, I think you bring up a very interesting point, because the context of the organization is, or the context of the industry is important too, because we can say that that's the case for police, that you join for life when you join up. Today, I'm not sure that that's always the case. It definitely changes in military organizations depending on what the expectation is. Well, also, it depends on what they're recruiting for. So we kind of look at the U.S. Army and some of the other U.S. services. There have been periods of time in which we were trying to recruit people with very strong technical backgrounds, because we needed that type of a person, knowing full well that there was a chance that their commitment to military service was not for, you know, lifelong or for career. We were encouraging people to come in using things like the GI Bill, which is an American program to provide college or defray college costs for those who enlist in the armed forces. And so that obviously, in terms of a return on investment, you're going to get these folks for a period of time, not all the way to 20 years, which is the American's retirement level. You get them for 4 to 6 or what have you, and then they go off, and it becomes a launching point for their individual careers. That it's shifted a bit now, because we're really looking for more stability in the force. We want to try to keep people for longer. We want to have incentives that encourage staying in for, you know, 10, 20 years or what have you. I mean, it shifts over time. And I'm sure that that's the same with just about any organization, that if you're if you find yourself wanting for people to come in, you're going to provide incentives that may encourage more short-term commitments as opposed to long-term commitments.
I was just going to say on both of your points that one for Miranda is that I agree that seems to be more the case now as we increase specialization, and that kind of any professional career seems to be almost a lifelong choice at this point because of the asset specificity of skills and the knowledge that is involved. And then to piggyback on what Tom said, that I was thinking, yeah, because when militaries advertise, it's about, you know, excitement, commitment, making a difference, and learning this, this, and that skill. There's a certain temporality that is kind of built into the expectation of this particular job role. Well, I think there is. I'm not sure if that's the same with police force, to be honest. I've not seen police recruitment videos, so can't really judge there. But I think a function of the complexification of work in general, of professional work, at least plays a role in that. Yeah, it's the more stuff you need to know to do a particular profession, the longer it takes to learn that stuff, that of course decreases the chances of switching tracks dramatically.
Well, but let's unpack that, because I think one thing is the commitment to a trade, an occupation, a specialization, and the other is to the organization, you know. Because here, in the case of Van Manen, you have both. Both coincide. It's about becoming someone, learning a practice, or becoming a policeman or policewoman, and joining the police force, because you can't be a policewoman or policeman in an odd organization. You know, there is no alternatives as there are engineering firms ABC. You know, can be an engineer in different organizations. So I think that's, yes, maybe the complexification of the work makes people to relate more to their career. But also nowadays, what I imagine is people jump much more around different organizations. You know, think of an engineer that might work in a more project-based kind of thing. And that raises the question, is organizational socialization still important in today's day and age?
Well, I touched upon this in my doctoral work, that what is the thing that organizations bring to the table when you're looking at these more practice-level forces. And I can't say definitively with regards to this, but I think in at least judging by what Van Manen is saying here, that there is a large aspect to organization being a precinct, or kind of this more localized version of the organization, a precinct or a squad even, plays a huge role in kind of forming the identity and the worker that is the police officer. So I definitely can envision a situation where a person socialized in one police force might have difficulty transitioning to another police force. Not necessarily within a force, but between different forces, or slightly between levels, like local to national and so on and so forth.
And I would definitely agree with you. Because in my field, you know, as a military officer, there was the necessity for a socialization process with each reassignment, especially if you were, say, moving from a force that was a domestically based force, something within the United States, and then you find yourself reassigned to a Germany or a Korea, which is where two places that we send a lot of troops. And there's a re-socialization process that comes with that as well.
Because one thing that I was emphasizing in my thesis was that in order to understand what is the role that organization plays in all this, you have to ask yourself, what are the specific things that people are doing that aid organizational outcomes? And that was kind of my lens through which I would separate the broader aspects of what's happening of the practice from the more kind of organization specific aspects. And I admit using that on a police force is at least at first glance kind of less helpful than one would imagine, because, you know, police does, you know, what law enforcement does it across the board, and, you know, there you go. But then if we take Van Manen's study and we look at the dynamics between the mentor and mentee, as it were, between the experienced officer and the newbie, and the socialization process within a precinct, then that kind of becomes very obvious that local matters a lot in these settings, and that kind of basically what Tom said, that there is a separate flavor of socialization between different localities within the same organization, that even at the one that even at first glance kind of seems to do the same thing across the board.
Okay, so two things. If I understand correctly, you're saying that there is the matter of the matching that exists between the work of the different specialists, you know, occupations, whatever you want to call them, and the one of the organizational goals. In the case of the police force, there is almost like a natural matching between what the police force does and the goal of the police organization, but not in more complex situations, it's not like that. Was that what you were saying, or I'm just like putting words?
I'm going to go with words, but that might be because we have a syntactic boundary happening here. Maybe, I mean, I suppose. So let's put it that way, that, you know, across a police department that is ostensibly a practice, you know, law enforcement, with all its associated sub-practices and institutions and all that kind of thing, you know, there are precincts, and each precinct is located in a different geography, dealing with different, you know, social environments and its particular profile of law enforcement that it needs to enforce. And that is where the difference comes in, so that the skills and activities and tasks and attitudes from Van Manen that patrol officers within a particular precinct needs to develop and execute in order to do the job that is specific to their particular environment is the contribution that this locality has towards their kind of formation and their practice. So that's why transferring to a different locality that has a different profile of practices and tasks and kind of the crime that needs to deal with and the skills that are required to do so may be problematic, even though they police officers are identifiably practitioners of law enforcement wherever they are. But I don't think we should kind of go too deep into this.
Okay, so let's backtrack. I think my question is, looking at what we are discussing, what are we to make up of today's situation in which, you know, work is more based on projects, or, you know, we can talk about the gig economy. So do we have a case in which socialization remains important? Because you're talking about the fact that, you know, and Tom was talking about the same thing, you have different localities and different places of work, and that actually usually require a kind of preparation for understanding that context. Socialization is still important, but maybe not necessarily the long-term commitment, the kind of, you know, full conformity that comes with a specific kind of, you know, more old school socialization, so to speak. So are we entering an era of socialization without commitment?
If we think about the opposition between or the example of projects that are short term, maybe there is no time to undergo the entire socialization process. So in some ways, there needs to be greater attention in the selection process, to basically select people that in some ways have already gone through the hurdles that, or the targets that a hypothetical socialization process would aim for. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Common experience, like almost this pan-tribalism, kind of sidestepping the socialization that is interpersonal and kind of going straight to this kind of a meta familiarity that people with the same experiences have to yourself, which is kind of also really ominous in a number of ways, that it just closes so many doors and creates such a such exclusivity. But I mean, maybe I can definitely see that. So after Miranda said, and just thinking about the characteristics of project-based organizations, there is a lot of that going on, that the selection and the recruitment is based around familiarity rather than around socialization.
Yes, well, I have actually, this makes me think of the great work by Lauren Rivera, which is organizational ethnographer. She was looking at the hiring practices in the consulting industry. I think it was management consulting, if I'm not mistaken, in the US. And what she found is that the hiring practice is much more about what she calls a cultural matching than actually screening for specific skills. So, you know, when she was she's an ethnography of a variety of firms and how the HR approach these candidates and select them. And she looked that they were looking not so much of the grades of the people or the previous experience that they have. It was more about, you know, what kind of hobbies do they have? What kind of societies were they part during their undergrad? You know, so kind of, you know, creating what you could call this like super tribal kind of shared kind of, you know, socioeconomic taste kind of personas. Because these are, interestingly, you know, product-based organizations. So,
I was just thinking, on the basis of experiences of friends, of people that, of acquaintances that I know that have recently gone through hiring processes, much of the selection is based on their values. So, if one of the targets of a socialization process from scratch would be to enhance the belief in certain values, now we're talking about hiring people who already have that belief. Or even just the tendency to ask people who are currently employed in a large organization that it's project-based or team-based to provide suggestions of other people that could be hired. So working on the networks of the current employees.
And that's all for part 2 of episode 38. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we conclude our discussion of the work by Van Manen on police socialization here, on Talking About Organizations.